Well, brethren, as I'm sure most of you are aware, the Apostle Paul plays a very significant and even unique role in the New Testament. He is the author of more books of the New Testament than any other single individual. And if you read through the book of Acts, he is the major focus within the book. You know, him and his ministry are a major, if not the primary focus of the majority of the book. Their other apostles are certainly mentioned and their accounts are included. But when you look from about chapter 13 through the end of the book, it's a major focus upon Paul. And Paul also tells us in his second epistle to the Corinthians that due to this unique role that he fulfilled, he was also given a thorn in the flesh. It was an issue that troubled him for much of his life, and as he explains to us in 2 Corinthians 12, he appealed to God at least three times to have this issue removed from him. But the answer that he received from God was, "My grace is sufficient for you." God basically told him that, "No, Paul, this is an issue you're just going to have to endure and put up with, but it's for your ultimate good." Well, throughout my lifetime, I've heard a good bit of speculation as to what exactly was this thorn in the flesh that Paul had to deal with. So what we're going to do today in the sermon is take a closer look at this to understand what exactly does the Bible tell us was this thorn in the flesh that Paul was dealing with, and more importantly, what are the lessons that we can learn and apply in our lives today from this particular account. So if you'd like a title for the sermon, it's the Apostle Paul's Thorn in the Flesh. Again, the Apostle Paul's Thorn in the Flesh. So to start off with, let's turn over to 2 Corinthians 12. This is the account where Paul mentions this. Again, 2 Corinthians in chapter 12. And we'll start reading in verse 7. It says, "And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, I am strong.'" So as we can see, you know, whatever this issue was, it was obviously something that was unpleasant, that, you know, that Paul did not particularly enjoy. You know, he had appealed at least three times, as he tells us here, to have this issue taken away from him. So obviously it was something he would have preferred not to have to deal with. You know, and the answer he's received is, "No, Paul, you're going to have to put up with this, and it's for your own good." And we can see from the latter, you know, couple of verses we read there, that Paul came to the same conclusion that, yes, I accept that this is, you know, for my ultimate good, and it's better for me that, I, even though I don't like this, that I have to endure through it. Well, what we're going to do today is, again, look in greater detail to see what exactly was this. Because, again, as I mentioned, throughout my lifetime, I've heard a lot of speculation, particularly about, you know, what exactly was this thorn in the flesh. And most often, it is speculated to be a medical problem. And the reason of that is that the phrase thorn in the flesh is typically interpreted very literally. And they say, okay, well, this is something affecting his flesh, so it must be a medical problem. And then from that speculation, they then go and look at some of the verses in his epistles that certainly seem to indicate he had some type of a vision issue that he was dealing with. And they think, well, maybe that thorn in the flesh was a vision problem. It was a problem with his eyes, and that's what he's dealing with. Now, again, we'll get into in a minute here in more detail how the Bible uses this term thorn in the flesh or similar language. But first, let's also just focus on what the purpose of this was. Because, see, in the latter part of the verse here, it says, "A messenger of Satan to buffet me." Now, what does buffet him mean? Now, to understand that, let's look at the Greek word that's translated into English here as buffet. Because, again, we don't typically use the word buffet a lot in our everyday English today, so it doesn't give us a clear meaning. But if we look at the Greek here, we can get a better, clearer idea as to what exactly he's getting at. Now, the Greek word here is transliterated into English is kolaphizo. It's K-O-L-A-P-H-I-Z-O. It's Strong's number 2852. And the definition I'm going to give you comes from the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the New Testament by Spyros Syantes. And the definition he provides for it is, quote, to strike with the fist, to buffet, to mistreat. So in other words, what this thorn in the flesh was something that would mistreat him. Well, we can see right there why he was appealing multiple times for God to take it away. You know, something that mistreats you is something you'd like to go away and not have to deal with. But why was this to mistreat him? Well, let's continue reading at the latter part of this verse here. It says, lest I be exalted above measure. Now, if you see that phrase, exalted above measure, that's at the beginning of verse 7 and at the end. Now, in both cases, it's three words in English. It's one word in Greek. Now, the Greek word here that's, you know, translated into those three English words is transliterated into English as huperaro. It's H-U-P-E-R-A-I-R-O. Strong's number 5229. And again from Zahiates, the definition he gives it is to lift above, elevate, exalt, be conceited, arrogant, insolent. So you can see what this was basically something given to Paul's life that would mistreat him for the purposes of preventing him from becoming conceited or arrogant, or to use kind of our modern day vernacular, to become full of himself, you know, to become big-headed and full of pride. You know, that's kind of the objective here. And we'll see here that, you know, later in this sermon, you know, this is specifically because of the abundance of revelation. It's because of this unique role that Paul is given, is to, you know, this is basically to keep him humble so that this unique role that he is given, you know, he doesn't become full of pride and doesn't go around boasting of how special he is and, you know, what a big alpha male he is. And it's, you know, it's to prevent that human nature tendency is what this is about. But now let's look into what exactly was this thorn in the flesh. Because as I mentioned, throughout my lifetime, you know, most often this phrase thorn in the flesh is taken very literally. In other words, intended, well, it's something affecting his flesh, so it must be a medical problem. Well, what this logic misses is that the Bible uses this type of language about a thorn, like a thorn in the flesh or a thorn in the side. We'll see several ways that this, you know, particular, you know, phraseology is used around a thorn, but it's used as an expression very much as how we use that, you know, type of expression in our English, you know, today. Because today we'll refer to a problem that's a thorn in our side, or an individual that just irritates us as, you know, that person is just a thorn in my side, or this situation has just been a thorn in my side. You know, and we're not referring to a medical problem, something that gives us, you know, physical pain from a medical standpoint. We're referring to something that's just troubling and is an annoyance and makes our life difficult and painful to go through. Well, what we're going to see here is that the Bible uses this, you know, type of phraseology around a thorn very much the same way. And to see examples of this, turn over to Numbers chapter 33. Again, Numbers 33. What we're going to see here is several examples where the Bible uses, you know, this type of phraseology specifically in reference to, you know, the Canaanites and, you know, the other pagan nations that were in the Promised Land. You know, the Israelites were commanded, you know, when they took over the Promised Land, were told, you know, to wipe out these nations and drive them out of the Promised Land. And as you're probably aware, they were also given instructions, you know, not to enter into marriages with these individuals, you know, not to mix with their culture. And the whole purpose of that, again, that wasn't about, you know, mixing their bloodlines or you know, combining their DNA. It wasn't really a racial thing. It was more of a cultural religious issue. You know, because the instructions were always, well, if you enter in with, you know, marriages with them, well, then you'll start, you know, taking on their practices. You'll worship their gods. You'll basically take on their culture, and it'll pull you away from the true God. Well, they're warned numerous times if they don't follow God's instructions and staying away from these people, wiping them out, not being directly involved with them, that it's going to wind up being a thorn for them. And what we're going to see here in several examples in the Old Testament is it's phrased like a thorn in their side or a thorn in their eyes. There's various ways it's spoken of, but it's always using this reference to a thorn, again, not as a literal thorn that's causing physical medical pain. It's an expression to communicate a concept. But to notice this, let's start in Numbers 33 and verse 50. Now Jehovah spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you have crossed the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, destroy all their engraved stones, destroy all their molded images, and demolish all their high places. And you shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land and dwell in it, for I have given you the land to possess. And you shall divide the land by lot as an inheritance among your families. To the larger you shall give a larger inheritance, and to the smaller you shall give a smaller inheritance. And there everyone's inheritance shall be whatever falls to him by lot, and you shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall be that those whom you let remain shall be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall harass you in the land where you dwell. Moreover, it shall be that I will do to you as I thought to do to them." And notice how it refers to them as a thorn in your side. And again, it's not specifically referring to, the physical pain of, a thorn's poking me and I got a medical problem as a result. It's just, that's just going to be a constant problem. They're going to harass and oppress you. They're just going to cause problems for you. And it's just going to be an ongoing problem, because you didn't follow the instructions to wipe these people out and not have anything to do with them. But let's notice that he uses, through the Old Testament, that this particular phrase shows up multiple times, this reference to them being thorns, throughout several books here. So turn over to Joshua chapter 23. And we'll see here where Joshua, again, reiterates this same instruction. It's Joshua 23. And we'll start reading in verse 1. So now it came to pass a long time after Jehovah had given rest to Israel from all their enemies round about, that Joshua was old, advanced in age. And Joshua called all of Israel for their elders, and for their heads, for their judges, and for their officers, and said to them, "I am old, advanced in age. You have seen all that Jehovah your God has done to all these nations because of you. For Jehovah your God is he who fought for you. See, I have divided to you by lot these nations that remain, to be an inheritance for your tribes from the Jordan, and all the nations that I have cut off as far as the great sea westward. And Jehovah your God will expel them from before you and drive them out of your sight. So you shall possess their land, so Jehovah your God has promised you. Therefore, be very courageous to keep all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from it to the right or to the left, unless you go among those nations in whom remain you, and you shall not make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause anyone to swear by them, and you shall not serve them nor bow down to them. But you shall hold fast to Jehovah your God as you have done to this day. For Jehovah has driven out from before you great and strong nations, but as for you, no one has been able to stand against you to this day. One man of you shall chase a thousand, for Jehovah your God is he who fights for you as he has promised you. Therefore, take diligent heed to yourselves that you love Jehovah your God, or else If indeed you go back and cling to the remnant of these nations, these that remain among you, and make marriages with them, and go to them and they to you, know for certain that Jehovah your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which Jehovah your God has given you. Notice here we have basically the same concept being expressed. It's worded a little bit differently. It's, you know, thorns in your eyes rather than in your side. You know, but in both cases, again, this is an expression. It's a figure of speech that this is going to be an ongoing problem is what this is going to be. Now let's notice again in the book of Judges. Just turn over to Judges chapter 2. And we'll see again this same type of, you know, reference being made, you know, to the pagan nations about them. And again, we see this, you know, this reference to thorns as a figure of speech, and again, not as a literal medical problem. This is in Judges chapter 2 and verse 1. And then the angel of Jehovah came from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. Notice once again this concept of a thorn in their side, again, not as a reference to a medical problem, but just as a snare, a trap for them, just, you know, something that's going to trip them up and just create, you know, ongoing problems in their life if they don't deal with that. So now let's look back at where we started in 2 Corinthians 12, and look at this from the perspective that a thorn in the flesh, again, is not a reference specifically to a medical problem. It's an expression of something that's going to cause, you know, Paul problems in his life. Again, let's look back at 2 Corinthians 12. Let's look again at verse 7. Unless I should be exalted above measure, again, you know, be conceited, become full of himself and arrogant. This is to keep him humble is what this is about. By the abundance of the revelations, because of this unique role that Paul fulfilled, and we'll look more at that in detail here in a minute. A thorn in the flesh was given to me. Now again, if we just follow the trend in the Bible, you know, this is more of an expression. This is not specifically identifying a medical problem. This is just something to give him, you know, grief and cause problems in his life. You know, as we saw, the buffet means to mistreat. It's something to mistreat him. Now let's notice what it states is actually mistreating him. A messenger of Satan to buffet, to mistreat me. You know, lest I be exalted above measure. So the key phrase here is a messenger of Satan. Now, to understand what this is getting at, we just need to look at the Greek word that's translated as messenger here in English. It's transliterated into English as agelos. It's A-G-G-E-L-O-S. It's Strong's number 32. And again, the definition I'm going to give you is from Zahiates. He defines it as, quote, messenger, one sent to announce or proclaim. A messenger, one who is sent in order to announce, teach, perform, or explore anything. An angel, a celestial messenger, a being superior to man. God is represented as surrounded by a host of beings of a higher order than man. These he uses as his messengers and agents in administering the affairs of the world and promoting the welfare of humans. In 2 Peter 2 verse 4 and Jude 1 verse 6, so some of the angels that sinned are said to have been cast down to hell. They are called the angels of the devil or Satan. In Revelation 9 verse 11, the angel of the bottomless pit is the destroying angel. See, this word angelos here is the word that's typically translated in the New Testament as the word angel. Now, it can mean a messenger. It can refer to a physical human being who is being sent as a messenger. It can be used like that. But it's also often used to refer to angelic beings, to either righteous angels or, again, angels who sinned and who followed Satan in his rebellion, because that's what this is referring to here. This is an angel of Satan, and it's a demon that followed Satan in his rebellion. And just to see some examples to back that concept up, turn over to Matthew 25. And we'll see here where it specifically talks about the devil's angels, the messengers, the angels who sinned, who followed Satan. This is Matthew 25 and verse 41. Now, we're going to jump into a context here. This is, the latter part of this chapter is describing the scene where, Christ is separating the sheep from the goats. He's basically judging the rest of mankind at the end of, the period of time pictured by the eighth day. And, this is his final judgment to decide who goes into the kingdom of God and who goes into the lake of fire. But let's just jump into verse 41 and just notice the wording here. It says, "Then he will also say to those on the left hand, 'Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels.'" And angels here, again, this is the same Greek word that we just saw, translated as messenger in 2 Corinthians 12:7. But notice it's the devil and his angels. It's the devil and his messengers. This is the messengers of Satan. This is basically referring to the exact same thing that 2 Corinthians 12 is referring to here. And because this is basically talking about how they're going to eventually be thrown in the lake of fire, that's their ultimate fate. And we'll see a couple more verses here that, again, uses that same Greek word in this same context. Turn over to 2 Peter 2. In 2 Peter 2, and we're going to read verse 4. It says, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment." He's referring to the ultimate judgment of all the angels who rebelled and followed Satan. But again, the Greek word here, for angels is, again, the exact same Greek word we read in 2 Corinthians 12:7. This is the messengers of Satan. And just to see one other example, turn over to Jude. Jude's a one-chapter book that's just right before the book of Revelation. We're going to read Jude in verse 6. It says, "And the angels who did not keep their proper domain, but left their own habitation, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day." Again, just another reference to, these angels that sinned and followed Satan, they're ultimately going to be thrown in the lake of fire. But I want you to notice in all of this is, again, if we just follow that same Greek word in these examples, what a messenger of Satan is, as it's worded there in 2 Corinthians 12:7, we're talking about a demon. What Paul was saying was, there was a demon that was, buffeting, mistreating him, that was basically causing ongoing problems in his life, and this was for the purposes of keeping him humble. That's basically what he was saying here. And to see a good example of how this type of concept works, just turn over to the book of Job. I think because this gives us a very good illustration of how this concept works and how it plays out in our lives. And again, this is Job chapter 1. And we'll see here kind of the behind-the-scenes story of what took place in Job's life. Because, according to the way the account is recorded here, we have no reason to believe that Job understood what was happening behind the scenes while all these events were playing out in his life. He's just experiencing all this calamity that's taking place in his life and wondering what's going on and why is this happening to me. Well, we get the advantage in reading the book to read the first two chapters and to see what's happening behind the scenes from a spiritual perspective. But the dynamics of how this is described here in Job chapters 1 and 2 can really help us understand the concept of what Paul was getting at in 2 Corinthians 12. And to notice this, let's start in Job chapter 1 in verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Jehovah, and Satan also came among them. And Jehovah said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered Jehovah and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and walking back and forth on it." And then Jehovah said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered Jehovah and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him and around his household, around all that he has on every side? And you have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions and have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." So Jehovah said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person." And then Satan went out from the presence of Jehovah. I notice here that God is in charge the entire time. He's basically telling Satan exactly how far he can go. He's like, "You can go this far and no further." Because at this point in the story, he basically forbids Satan from touching, Job's health. He says, "You can go after every other part of his life, but you can't touch his health." Now, we're going to see a little bit later here, he removes that restriction. But notice here, when Satan goes after him, there's all manner of physical problems that happen in Job's life. His children are killed, his business is affected, his possessions are greatly affected by, and these are all physical calamities that are taking place in Job's life. But there's a spiritual source behind it of Satan himself who's bringing these events about. And pick up in verse 13. "Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them, when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away. Yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' And while he was still speaking, another came also and said, 'Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young men, and they are dead. And I have alone have escaped to tell you.' And then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell on the ground and worshipped and said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. Jehovah gave, and Jehovah has taken away. Blessed be the name of Jehovah.' And in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong." And notice up to this point, as I mentioned, God has set a restriction that Satan can't touch Job's health. Well, as we're going to read here in the beginning of chapter 2, he removes that restriction, and Satan's able to go after that as well. But what I want you to notice is there's all these other calamities that are happening in Job's life. And from Job's perspective as a physical human being, he doesn't understand what's happening. It's just calamities coming at him from every direction. But there's a spiritual force that's causing all of this to take place. And again, just understanding the dynamics of this are going to help us understand the picture of what this thorn in the flesh was for Paul, because this is what was happening in Paul's life. He's got a spiritual source that's creating all manner of persecution and problems in his life, and that's the source of what he's talking about there in 2 Corinthians 12. But let's just continue reading in chapter 2 here. Because as I mentioned, God now removes the restriction, on Satan and allows him to go after Job's health as well. This is chapter 2 and verse 1. says, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Jehovah. And Satan came also among them to present himself before Jehovah. And then Jehovah said to Satan, from where do you come? And Satan answered Jehovah and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. And then Jehovah said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. So Satan answered Jehovah and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. So see, he's basically saying, let me go after his health. If I go after his health, that'll really get to him. Now pick up in verse 6. So Jehovah said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. In other words, you can do anything to him, just don't kill him. In verse 7. Then Satan went out from the presence of Jehovah and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. And then his wife said to him, do you still hold to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. So shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? And in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So you can see here, Job's life basically just gets turned upside down and turned into a nightmare, you know, that nobody would ever want to go through. And the source behind all of this is Satan is behind the scenes bringing all this calamity upon him. Now, again, God's in control the entire time. He's setting restraints, you know, as to what Satan is allowed to do. But that's the source of all the problems. And we're going to see here, this is the key to understanding what the thorn in the flesh that Paul was dealing with was. But we also need to understand that this is a concept that applies to all of us as Christians. You know, not to necessarily to the severity of what Job went through. I'm sure none of us would want to go through, you know, what Job faced. And we probably don't face it at the level of which Paul dealt with us. But as Paul himself tells us, this same basic concept applies to everyone who's a Christian. In fact, it's a requirement in the contract for being a Christian. And to see this, turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 3. Because we'll see here that Paul himself, you know, gives us a very all-inclusive, you know, statement so that we just simply can't get around, you know, that tells us that this concept applies to all of us. It's just part of being a Christian. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12. Says, yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Notice it's an all-encompassing statement. He's not saying that, well, this applies to, you know, individuals like myself, you know, meaning Paul, you know, who fulfill this special role, or we're just referring to the prophets in the Old Testament, or, you know, just the apostles in the New Testament. No, he's saying this concept applies to everyone. I think it's also important for us to realize, notice he says everyone who wants to live godly in Christ Jesus, in other words, everyone who accepts Christ as their Savior. Well, that applies to everyone who's called, you know, in the future as well. You know, this applies to everyone who's offered salvation during the eighth day period as well. That's why Satan is released again after the millennium, is to fulfill the same role that he's fulfilling now. Because, see, oftentimes people will read this particular verse and they think of persecution, you know, only in the context of, you know, being thrown in prison for preaching the truth, or having lynch mobs, you know, want to beat you up and murder you for what you believe in. And while those concepts certainly apply to this, we have to realize that, you know, the persecution we're talking about is, again, is persecution from Satan and his demons. And that's something that we all face, again, not necessarily to the severity of having your life threatened or being thrown, imprisoned, or killed. You know, but as Peter tells us, he warns all of us that Satan is the persecutor out to get us. And to notice that, turn over to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. It says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking who he may devour." So he's telling us Satan is the persecutor. He's the one out to get all of us, and that's, you know, something we all have to struggle against. I think oftentimes we think of this in terms of, you know, temptation to sin, or, you know, trying to fight our human nature and the battle that we have to deal with there. And it certainly applies there, but we also have to think of it again in terms of Job's example. You know, of seeing, you know, calamities and, you know, physical things that can come at us in our lives to test and try us and to persecute and, you know, make our lives, you know, difficult for us, that can come from spiritual sources as well. But turn over to Ephesians chapter 6. This is probably a reference you're very familiar with in terms of, you know, thinking of what spiritual forces behind the scenes, how they will affect us. And again, we typically apply this to our battle with our human nature, which again is a very accurate, you know, connection with this. But let's also, again, think in terms of a little bigger than that, of how that can affect physical things in our lives as well. But this is Ephesians 6 in verse 12. "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places." So, you know, but both Peter and Paul here are telling us that, again, we have to deal with this persecution, you know, with these constant, you know, challenges in our lives and, you know, things that mistreat us, you know, and tempt us and try to be snares and traps for us. And there's a spiritual force behind it all. And again, this is a concept that applies to all of us. But to fully understand what Paul was dealing with, we have to understand the concept that, you know, Paul was in a special role. And there's the underlying concept behind all of this is basically the idea that to whom much is given, much is required. And see what I'm talking about. Let's turn back over to 2 Corinthians 12 here. But let's notice here that it specifically tells us that the reason that, you know, Paul was kind of singled out here, you know, to have this thorn in the flesh, you know, to have this persecution from Satan and his demons at a higher level than, you know, the average Christian is going to have to deal with, is because of this unique role that he had. And to notice here again in verse 7, it says, "Unless I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations." In other words, because of this unique role that Paul fulfilled. Because as I mentioned, you know, Paul writes more of the New Testament than any other single author. And, you know, as I also mentioned before, you know, the book of Acts has a, you know, strong focus upon Paul and upon his ministry. And, you know, Paul is a guy that, you know, Christ, you know, appeared in visions, you know, directly, you know, teaching him. He's, you know, spoken of in visions. He was taken up to heaven and the things that he saw. I mean, he had a very unique role in the revelations that he received and the role that he fulfilled, you know, for all time. Because, again, he writes the majority of the New Testament. Well, there's a package deal that comes with that. And to understand this concept, turn over to Mark chapter 10. We'll see here a conversation that takes place with the apostles, you know, James and John, who are oftentimes referred to as the sons of Zebedee, and a conversation that they have with Christ. Because, you know, more than just their particular example, what we can learn from this is, again, the concept of, again, basically to whom much is given, much is required. That if, you know, if you want to be put in a special role, you know, and have, you know, particular honor because of that role, well, there's a painful side that comes with that as well. You know, and just to kind of illustrate a personal example with this, a number of years ago, I was having a conversation with a good friend of mine, in fact, one of the best friends of my life. He was one of the ministers that ordained me an elder. And he was just talking about the tendency of a lot of people wanting to kind of self-promote themselves, or people, you know, who desire to be in a leadership role in the church, and kind of politic to, you know, to kind of put themselves in those roles. And the way that he would describe it is, he goes, oftentimes these are people who are looking for a title and not a job description. In other words, what he meant was, you know, they want to be called, you know, an elder or a pastor or some role of that nature, and they want to be behind the podium and, you know, preaching and telling people what they think and have people, you know, honoring and listening to what they say. He goes, but they oftentimes don't want, you know, the downside to the role. You know, they don't want to catch the grief and deal with the trials that come as a package with it. And see, this particular concept of there being, you know, kind of a proportional, you know, painful side to the role is something that Christ expresses here with the sons of Zebedee. And to understand this, let's start in Mark chapter 10 and verse 35. It says, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him saying, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us that we may sit on one on your right in the other on your right hand and in the other on your left hand in your glory." Now, see, what they're asking for is, we want the limelight. You know, we want to be right next to you and have everybody look at us as the big dogs and the alpha males that are, you're in charge of everything. That's what they're focused on. Now, notice that, you know, Christ's response to them, because he immediately tells them, you don't know what you're asking, you know, because there's a downside that comes with this that you're not taking into account. And pick up here in verse 38. But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you ask. Can you drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" And they said to him, "We can." And Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism that I am baptized, that you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but is for those to whom it is prepared." See, he was expressing to them, you know, they didn't realize what they were asking. And I'm sure at that point, they didn't. They didn't grasp the painful side that was going to come with this. And what Christ was getting at when he refers to the cup that I have to drink from, he was talking about, you know, the persecution, you know, and specifically, as we're going to see here, he's talking about, you know, the brutal beatings and murder, you know, that he's going to receive. And as Christ told them, he said, you know, you will indeed, you know, drink from that same cup. Well, you know, if you look at what happened with most of the apostles, you know, most all of these guys, you know, they were persecuted and they all got violently murdered at the end of their life. And to see that's what, you know, Christ meant by referring to the cup that he would drink from. Just turn over to Matthew chapter 26. Because we'll see here the account of it, and, you know, towards the end of, you know, Christ's physical life on earth. In fact, you know, the night right before he's about to be arrested and betrayed, and then his torture, you know, is about to begin before he's eventually murdered the next day. Notice here when he is praying to God, you know, basically asking for a plan B. You know, is there some way I can avoid this? And he makes, you know, similar to Paul, you know, he appeals three times for this to be taken away from him, you know, and he comes to the same conclusion the Apostle Paul does in 2 Corinthians 12, that, you know, okay, I'll endure it, and it's for the ultimate good that it takes place. But notice as Christ is making this prayer, how he refers to it as a cup. you know, he specifically uses the same language in referring to what he's going to go through here as he did when he was talking to the sons of Zebedee. And also notice as we read through this, that as this is playing out, the sons of Zebedee, James and John, are two of the individuals that are with him while this is taking place. Now let's pick up here in Matthew 26 in verse 36. And then Jesus came with them to the place called Gethsemane. And he said to the disciples, "Sit here while I go and pray over there." And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. So I think it's interesting that, you know, James and John were there as, you know, as part of the group that are with him while this is taking place. And pick up in verse 38. And then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me." And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, "O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." Again, now notice he's referring to the suffering he's about to go through as a cup. And picking up in verse 40, "Then he came to the disciples and found them asleep and said to Peter, 'What, could you not watch with me an hour? Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak.' And he went away again a second time and prayed, saying, 'O my Father, if this cup cannot pass from me unless I drink it, your will be done.' And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away again and prayed the third time, saying the same words. And he came to his disciples and said to them, 'Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Or rise and let us be going, so he who betrays me is at hand.'" So you can see from his comments here of he's about to be betrayed, obviously that's what he's referring to as the cup. You know, of taking this cup away from me. Now, as we can see here, as I mentioned, you know, this whole concept of, you know, having basically spiritual forces that will mistreat us, that we, you know, just try to cause problems in our lives and that will persecute us. Now, that is a concept that, again, that just applies to all Christians at some level. But as we saw here with the example of, you know, James and John and in their request to Christ, you know, that they wanted the chief seats, you know, they wanted to be right on each side of Christ there and have all the glory. Well, Christ was making the point to them, if you want to have the special role, there's a lot of pain that's going to come with that. It's a package deal. And see, this is the key to understanding why, you know, what happened with Paul, you know, in his situation of why he is specifically mentioned as receiving this thorn in the flesh, which we saw is, again, a messenger of Satan, an angel of Satan, a demon, you know, that's basically oppressing and mistreating Paul. Because this was basically made clear from the very beginning of Paul's ministry that he was going to have a very painful road to go. And to see that, turn over to Acts chapter 9. And this is Acts chapter 9. And this is the chapter where, you know, Paul is, you know, stricken down on the road to Damascus, you know, where he's, I mean, basically, you know, Christ gets his attention and tells him that he's basically, you know, persecuting his people, and then takes away his eyesight, and Paul's blind, and, you know, and now it's humbling him and getting his attention. Well, then Christ goes to Ananias and basically gives him the, you know, the instructions to go over and to, you know, to baptize Paul and to, you know, to perform a healing to restore his eyesight. But then let's notice here a comment that Christ makes when he's giving Ananias these instructions. And this is in Acts chapter 9. In verse 10. "Now there was a certain disciple at Damascus named Ananias. And to him the Lord said in a vision, 'Ananias,' and he said, 'Here I am, Lord.' And the Lord said to him, Arise and go to the street called Straight, and inquire at the house of Judas for one called Saul of Tarsus. For behold, he is praying. And in a vision, he has seen a man named Ananias coming in and putting his hand on him so that he might receive his sight. Then Ananias answered, Lord, I have heard from many about this man, how much harm he has done to your saints in Jerusalem. And here he has authority from the chief priests to bind all those who call on your name. But the Lord said to him, Go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. For I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. Now notice here that, you know, that Christ tells him, I've got plans for Paul. He's going to fulfill a special role for me, and it's going to hurt. In other words, Paul's going to have a lot of pain along the way. He's going to accomplish a lot of good, but it's going to hurt while he's doing it. And if we just, jump down the page here to verse 23, what we're going to see here is from the very beginning of Paul's ministry, he's got people plotting to kill him, attempting to kill him from the very beginning of his ministry. And this follows him throughout the rest of his life. And, he's eventually, like the rest of the other apostles, he's violently murdered. He's beheaded. Now, again, that particular detail is not recorded in the Bible, but that's, generally agreed upon among historians that his life was ended by being beheaded. But let's just notice what was happening to him just as soon as he started his ministry. This is down in verse 23. Now, after many days were passed, the Jews plotted to kill him. But their plot became known to Saul, and they watched the gates day and night to kill him. And then the disciples took him by night and let him down through the wall in a large basket. So see, Paul is constantly running for his life, throughout all of his ministry of people trying to kill him. And he also gets violently attacked many times. So turn over to 2 Corinthians 11. And we'll see here the list, kind of the overview of all the issues that Paul had to deal with. And also just take note as we read through this, that this is just one chapter right before he talks about his thorn in the flesh. Because again, these are directly related. This is 2 Corinthians 11, and we'll start in verse 22. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked, a night and a day. I have been in the deep, in journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils of the city, in perils of the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren. In weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings, in cold and nakedness. Besides other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. So that's an incredible list, that none of us would want to have as part of our own life, of all the trials that he had to go through. See, this is the thorn in the flesh that Paul was referring to. He had a demon basically specifically coming to stir up trouble in his life. And again, it was through multiple means. It wasn't just specifically a health problem. It's kind of similar to Job, where you've got all of these, various problems coming from multiple angles and constantly coming at you. Where it can include, medical issues, but it's not specifically, narrowly defined as just that. He's constantly being mistreated, buffeted, as we read. And again, this is for the purposes of keeping him humble. And see, that's one of the big lessons that we can learn from this. Because as we read earlier, you know, in Paul's example, he appealed to God multiple times to have this taken away from him. And the answer he got was no. You know, the answer he got was, my grace is sufficient for you, but this is for your ultimate good. And he accepted that. So let's just notice here, again, let's pick up in chapter 12 here in verse 8. It says, concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. Now, as you can imagine from the list that we just read, you know, of all the persecutions he received, you can definitely see why he would be appealing multiple times, please make this stop. You know, I'm not enjoying, you know, that every time I turn around, someone's trying to kill me. You know, so someone's beating me up. They're throwing me in prison. You know, I'm just harassed constantly everywhere I go. You can imagine why he would be, you know, appealing to God multiple times, please make this stop. You know, now, pick up in verse 9. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. And therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, I am strong. See, one of the big lessons that we can learn from this is, again, the trials that we go through, that you know, we oftentimes plead, you know, God, please take this away from me because I'm not enjoying this trial. You know, while it's certainly appropriate to do that and to ask for, you know, God to remove that or at least give us the strength to get through it, it's also important to realize it's for our ultimate good. You know, because he does it ultimately to build his character in us. And even though it's a painful, unpleasant experience for us to go through, it is ultimately for our benefit. And to see an example of that, turn over to Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5. And we'll start reading here in verse 3. And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance, character, and character, hope. And now, hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit who was given to us. He's telling us that, you know, these harsh trials that we have to go through, it builds God's character in us. And even though it's not something that we enjoy going through, it is for our ultimate good. And see, this is why the Apostle James, you know, tells us to count this all as joy, as something good in our life. Now, that's something easy to say and very hard to do, but let's just turn over to James chapter 1 and see this. James chapter 1 and verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. And again, as I mentioned, that's easy to say and hard to do. I know if you're anything like me, when I'm getting hit with trials, I don't think, oh, goody, this is so great, I'm getting beat up by trials. You know, no, normally it's the opposite. You know, it's Lord, please take this away. You know, I'm not enjoying these trials. You know, and I think that's how most of us, you know, will respond to it. But again, to continue in our Christian lives, I think it's important for us to realize it is for our ultimate good. In fact, it's only after we've successfully endured through those trials that we can receive eternal life. And to see that, just jump down to verse 12 here of James chapter 1. It says, blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been proved, he will receive the crown of life with which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Now, if you look at the English word there, proved, in my New King James here in verse 12, it's translated from the Greek word dokimos. It's D-O-K-I-M-O-S, Strong's number 1384. And again, the definition I'm going to give you comes from Zahiates. He defines it as proved receivable, tried as metals by fire, and thus be purified, hence to be approved as acceptable men in the furnace of adversity. In other words, we don't receive eternal life until we've been proven through the furnace of adversity, and until we've successfully endured through those trials. So we can see here, even though we may face, you know, the thorn in our flesh at a much less severe level, you know, than Paul did, I'm sure we would all prefer to deal with it at a much, you know, less severe level than Paul did. The principle is the same for us. You know, we have to endure through that because it's for our benefit. Just like in Paul's case, where, you know, this was to keep him humble, again, specifically because, again, he did have an abundance of revelation. He fulfilled a role that, you know, most all of us are never going to have, you know, be asked to fulfill and never be given that opportunity. You know, well, we also don't have the same level of pain that he had to go through. But the same basic concepts apply to us. You know, we all have to face that spiritual persecution, and we all have to successfully endure through it. And one of the keys to that is, again, realizing, just like Paul did, that it's for our ultimate good, that God does it out of love, and it's to build our character. And if we successfully endure through it, we'll make it into his kingdom. And when we're looking back, we'll think it was all worth it. So, brethren, as we go forward from this Sabbath in our Christian lives, let's learn from Paul's example and his thorn in the flesh, and realize that we have a thorn in the flesh to deal with as well. It's basically the same thing, you know, hopefully at a less, you know, much less severe level, but we face the same type of issues. We have that spiritual persecution, that, and we have to successfully endure through it as well. So let's learn from the example of the Apostle Paul, and realize that God gives us that thorn in the flesh to deal with for our ultimate good.